H.L. Mencken once defined Puritanism as the haunting fear that somewhere, somehow, somebody may be happy. How dreadful. Puritans were known for being very stern people. They will not go down in history as a bunch of fun-loving galoots. And there was probably good reason for that. Here in America, particularly when the Puritans came to America, how they treated their kids was pretty stern. Children were not allowed recess time at school. They were not allowed to have toys or games in their homes. They had to be up at sunrise. They had all kinds of chores that they had to do every day. So being a child of Puritan parents was not a joyful thing, and hence their reputation as being rather stern people. That's one view of pleasure, to take the Puritan approach, where life is all serious, life is all about work and duty and responsibility. Now, the other end of the spectrum is a thing called hedonism. Hedonism is the enthroning of pleasure as life's highest aim, the goal that everyone should pursue, and the idea of attaining pleasure and helping others attain pleasure is the purpose of life. Now, that's just the opposite extreme, that life is just one fun-loving party after another. And I think the truth is somewhere, as it usually is, the truth is often between two extremes. There is a valid place for fun and recreation and pleasure in our lives. There's nothing wrong with having fun. And I think it's a particular problem, or it's a particular challenge, I think, for Americans, particularly Americans who are Christians. Since World War II, our level of affluence has just steadily gone up and up and up and up. On a basis of per capita income, we're not the wealthiest country in the world. We're one of the top ones. But in terms of our affluence, in terms of convenience, in terms of pleasure, in terms of entertainment and recreation, we are second to nobody. Very much of our culture is geared toward convenience and pleasure and fun and things like that. Since World War II, there's been a discernible shift away from savings to spending. There has been a discernible shift from self-discipline to self-indulgence. There has been a discernible shift from investment to amusement. You think about how much money Americans spend just on fun, on vacations, on consumer electronics, on movies and Netflix, and all of those things that we do on a recreational basis. Many years ago, I had a good friend of mine who was a member of a church up in Murray. And I had heard the term, I'd seen the term in like personal finance classes or economic classes, but I'd never heard a person use the term regularly. He used the term disposable income. I don't like that term. Now, I'll be blunt. We all throw away money. But just the very idea that there is some income that is disposable, you just kind of throw it away. Money that I prefer thinking fun money, but anyway, it's disposable income. It's money we throw away. And yet, that amount of money that most people have in their budgets, we have allowances for that kind of thing, which says a lot about our level of affluence. There are more and more things we can do, cheaper and cheaper, and they are more readily available in American culture. So it can be a very big challenge for those of us who are Christians living in America. How do we actually put this into some kind of balance? And I would say it's even spilled over into religious thinking. Anytime you turn on a television evangelist, you are likely to land on a station where somebody's preaching the health and wealth gospel. The idea that if you're not wealthy, you're not living a good Christian life. The idea that being a Christian is all about money and God will bless you materially. So even the hedonistic mindset can spill over into that as well. I figured that with summer coming upon us, it would be a good time tonight to talk about pleasure and fun and recreation and things like that. What does the Bible say about that? Is it legitimate for us to pursue things that are enjoyable? How much fun can we have? What are the principles that govern that? I want to say at the outset, the Bible is not opposed to Christians having good, clean fun. I think those three words, though, are very important. So we're going to look tonight at some of the principles that the Bible gives us about this business of pleasure and recreation and entertainment. I want to start out with a couple of definitions. Pleasure is the gratification of the senses or of the mind, agreeable sensations or emotions, a feeling produced by enjoyment or expectation of good. It's similar to the concept of joy, probably not exactly the same. The Bible talks a lot more about joy than it does anything else. The Bible doesn't really talk much about pleasure. It talks about it some, but the emphasis in the Bible is really more on the aspect of joy. When you think about the biblical concept of pleasure and joy, both of these things are from God. Turn back to Ecclesiastes, which is where we started a moment ago. A passage was read from Ecclesiastes 11. Ecclesiastes 11, near the end of the book, and as he winds down his final arguments and exhortations, there's a special section where he is aiming it at the young crowd. And I think the point that he's making here is that fun is perfectly acceptable. Pleasure is perfectly acceptable. In fact, at some level, you can pursue it, but just remember, you'll be judged for it, so be careful about the kinds of pleasure that you pursue. Ecclesiastes 11, verse 6, "Sow your seed in the morning and do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed or whether both of them alike are good. The light is pleasant, and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything that is to come will be futility. Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood. And follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes, yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things." He's saying, young man, go have some fun. Have some responsible fun. But have some fun, because there will come a time when you may not have the opportunities, you may not have the health, you may not have the time, you may have more obligations that come, and so you may not have the opportunities to do these kinds of things. But I think that's a fairly consistent theme in the book of Ecclesiastes. You go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, for instance. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, there are several places throughout the book where you have this brief exhortation just thrown into the middle of a long series of arguments. And you'll have these brief exhortations about, okay, now where are we at? Here's what you need to do. You need to enjoy things. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 24, "There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him?" That's talking about pleasure. Is talking about the joy of day-to-day experiences. And he says, you work hard at what you do, you should be able to enjoy the fruit of that labor. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 12, "I know there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all of his labor. It is the gift of God." God gives us the ability to work. He gives us the opportunities, but he also gives us the capacity and the opportunities to enjoy those things. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 18. "Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labors in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward." What is his reward? To be able to enjoy the fruit of his labor. So God gives us not only the capacity to work, but also the capacity to enjoy the work that we do, the capacity and the opportunities to find pleasure in the work that we do, and to find moments of joy and fulfillment in these things. You even see this in the life of Jesus. There are several statements in the Gospels where Jesus took his apostles in the middle of their busy schedules and said, let's get away for a while. For example, in Mark chapter 6, Mark chapter 6 and verse 30, the apostles gathered together with Jesus, and they reported to him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, come away by yourselves to a secluded place and rest a while. For there were many people coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. Now that's a shame. You don't have time to eat, something's wrong. I'm all for food. I'm very much in favor of food. So make sure you got time to eat. Jesus set that example. And it's interesting that he had apparently had just sent out his apostles. They came back with some reports of what they had done, and he thought, okay, you've been on a journey, you've been doing all of this extra work, now we're going to take some time, basically a vacation. We're going to take a break from our routine. They went away to a secluded place because they were constantly surrounded by people. Yeah, I was talking to someone this morning. For many years, now, when I was growing up, we didn't have vacations very much. We always went to see relatives. A few times we did go on vacations, but most of the time it was always to go see relatives, and we had relatives everywhere. And as my wife and I got older, we made some as we got married and started having kids, and we do go and see family, but we made some decisions. Every now and then we're going to have a vacation. There is a difference between visitation and vacation. Vacation is, I don't know anybody here. I don't want to know anybody here. I want to get away. I want to do what Jesus is talking about, be secluded, get away from the crowd for a while. To me, that is vacation. And Jesus did that kind of thing. Luke chapter 10, another reference to this, Luke chapter 10, down in verse 38. Now as they were traveling along, he entered a village. A woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister called Mary who was seated at the Lord's feet listening to his word. And we know the rest of the story, but on this occasion, Jesus just took some time to visit with friends. They got together, they had a meal, they relaxed for a while, and actually Martha is the one who's kind of wound up about the whole thing. And actually, he gives a little bit of a rebuke to her. Relax. Take it easy. There is nothing wrong with enjoying your time off. There's nothing wrong with enjoying these social occasions. And one of my favorite passages, Luke chapter 5, verse 29. Luke 5:29. There are multiple references to this throughout the Gospels. And Levi gave a big reception for him in his house, and there was a great crowd of tax collectors and other people who were reclining at the table with them. And the Pharisees and their scribes again grumbling at his disciples, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? And then he went on to describe his particular mission. Jesus socialized with others, and he did not always just socialize with people in his immediate group. Yeah, that's what he did when he was visiting with Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Yes, there were times when he spent unique time with his apostles and his disciples, but there were other times he simply socialized with large groups, and there was nothing wrong with that. So that's kind of the picture that we have in the Bible. God commends to us these pleasures. He says they are things that are perfectly legitimate to pursue, perfectly legitimate to have. It is perfectly legitimate to enjoy them. The Bible also talks about God's pleasure. Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, verse 13. Paul said, for it is God who is at work in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. I think the reason why, and this is true with so many things that we do as children of God, the reason why pleasure and enjoyment and recreation are things that are commended to God's people is because God himself derives pleasure from certain things. Now, the context here is our obedience. God derives pleasure when he sees our obedience. But nonetheless, the very idea that God delights in things, that God takes pleasure in certain things, is the foundation for us taking pleasure in certain things as well. Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 16. And do not neglect doing good and sharing, for with such sacrifices God is what? God is pleased. God takes pleasure in certain things. And notice here, the sharing and the sacrifices, that involves doing good with other people, doing good for other people. I think you'd have to put social things in this category as well. God takes pleasure and delight when he sees his people doing certain things. And again, God has given pleasure and given things to us in our lives for us to enjoy. Back in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 15, so I commended pleasure, for there is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat and drink and be merry, and this will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life, which God has given to him under the sun. Now, sometimes you can go overboard. Paul warned a little bit about the mentality that eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Now, he puts that in the context of the resurrection. But I think Solomon is using it in a little bit different sense. Here in this life, there are a lot of times, there are a lot of burdens that we have in life. There are a lot of things we struggle with. And so when you have the opportunity, God gives us those occasions again for us to have joy and pleasure. So he says, a God-given gift is the ability to eat and drink and be merry. Now, one other thing we need to understand, that all pleasures are morally neutral. Pleasure in and of itself is not wrong. It's not right. It just is. Pleasure is never morally right or wrong in the Bible. It depends on how we use those things. For example, the Bible has a fair amount of things to say about sex. Sex is not right or wrong. It depends on the context. The context makes it right or wrong. Whether we're doing it within the parameters that God has given us, or if we're going outside those parameters, that determines the rightness and wrongness of it. Notice in Proverbs chapter 5. Proverbs chapter 5, starting in verse 15. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 15. He says, drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? Now, he's talking about sex in two different contexts. In one context, if it's with your wife, he says that's a great thing. That's a blessing. That's something you should enjoy. If it's with somebody else's wife, no, there's nothing good about that. The act of sex is not the issue. It is the context in which it occurs. You can say the same thing about alcohol. Alcohol, you go to Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs chapter 23. Starting in verse 29, who has woe, who has sorrow, who has contentions, who has complaining, who has wounds without cause, who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long over wine, those who go to taste mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red and when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At last it bites like a serpent and yet stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things and your mind will utter perverse things. He's talking there about the dangers of it, and yet Paul could also give advice to Timothy, no longer drink water exclusively, but take a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent ailments. There are some contexts in which alcoholic beverages might be good, like health issues. Paul made that application. But then the general biblical consensus is don't pursue it at all. Pleasure is morally neutral. It depends on the context in which it occurs, but the Bible also talks about some pleasures that are harmful. One of the most interesting statements to me in the Bible about pleasure is in Hebrews chapter 11 when it's talking about Moses' example of faith. Hebrews chapter 11, in verse 23, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid for the king's edict. But by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. The passing pleasures of sin. That's the problem with pleasure. Sin is pleasurable. Now, maybe we preachers don't like to admit that, but hey, sin is fun. Sin brings pleasure. Why do you think people do it? Let me ask you something. If every time you sinned, you got this searing, agonizing pain that started in your big toe and went all the way up your spine and went out your head, and you were racked in pain for hours and hours and hours every time you sinned, how often do you think you'd do that? Probably not very. And I know a few people who probably do it anyway. But most of us would say, no, I don't want anything to do with that. Why is sin so appealing? Because it has pleasure. What sin usually does, it takes a legitimate pleasure and encourages you to use it in an illegitimate way, like we were talking about earlier with sex or wine or things like that. Money is perfectly legitimate. Bible gives us all kinds of advice about money, but when money becomes your God, there's a problem. And what Moses had to do, he saw that there was an opportunity for him. He could stay and work within the confines of the Egyptian government, and he could rise to power, and maybe he would have thought, well, I can help the Israelites that way. No, he realized he had to take a stand. Was he an Israelite or was he an Egyptian? If he went with the Egyptian route, he would be compromising, and that would be the passing pleasures of sin. He rejected that. So there are harmful pleasures. Now again, pleasure in itself is morally neutral, but how we use it determines the rightness or wrongness of it. I want to spend the rest of our time in our lesson talking about some of the principles we need to follow. I call these the pleasure principles. We need to consider how pleasure affects various things in our lives. Number one, how does pleasure affect your body? Does it affect your capacity to serve God? 1 Corinthians chapter 6, I think this to me is one of the best passages in the New Testament that deals with the usage of our bodies. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Now, 1 Corinthians 6, verses 12 through 20, he's addressing one specific issue. Apparently, there were some Christians in the city of Corinth who felt perfectly comfortable using the services of a prostitute. And he addresses that and he says, no, your body was made for something better than that. But he brings up this whole idea of why we have our bodies and what we're supposed to do with them. He says in verse 19, do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own? For you have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body. You are to seek God's glory by how you use your body, whatever usage that is. Now, I understand that the specific application here is to fornication, but I believe that this principle applies to a lot of things. I believe it applies to many, many other things. The way that you use your body, does it bring glory to God or does it bring glory to self? Is it all about the pleasure that you're pursuing, or are you trying to use your body as an instrument of service to God? Your body makes a wonderful instrument. It makes a lousy master. And the problem that Paul is dealing with here is people who let their bodily desires become their masters. Your body was never intended to control you. You are always intended to control your body. He picks up on this theme again in chapter 9, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24. He says, do you not know that those who run in the race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. We are encouraged to exercise self-control over our bodies. How do your pleasures affect the way that you use your body? That's one of the big issues that we need to address. How does pleasure affect your character? Do you let others affect you? Do you let the influence of other people bring you down a notch or two? 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, Paul said, do not be conceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. So in the pursuit of fun, are you hanging out with the wrong crowd? And that applies to adults every bit as much as it applies to teenagers. I know that customarily we're supposed to tee off on the teens at this point, but I know some adults that struggle with that. Need to choose good friends. You need to make sure that your companions are not dragging you into some areas where you don't need to go. At the same time, we need to be concerned about how we affect others as well. Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs 23. In verse 17. Do not let your heart envy sinners, but live in fear of the Lord always. Surely there is a future and your hope will not be cut off. Listen, my son, and be wise, and direct your heart in the way. Do not be with heavy drinkers of wine or gluttonous eaters of meat, for the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe one with rags. You're either a good effect on others, or others are have an effect on you. You need to make up your mind about how your character, how you use your character in relationship to pleasure. The effects that we have on others, again, that's something that we have to be concerned about. In Matthew chapter 5, we looked this morning, verses 13 through 16, at our influence as salt and light. By the way that you live your life, people will see what kind of character you possess. And I won't rehash this morning's sermon, but the point is, you exert an influence on others. It's either an influence for good or an influence for evil, and you need to make up your mind which. How does pleasure affect your priorities? Proverbs chapter 28. Proverbs chapter 28. Verse 19, he who tills his land will have plenty of food, but he who follows empty pursuits will have poverty in plenty. Wow. And then verse 20 is the follow-up to that. A faithful man will abound with blessings, but he who makes haste to be rich will not go unpunished. I like the second part of verse 19. He who follows empty pursuits will have poverty in plenty. Have you ever known anybody, they've always got big plans? They always dream big. There's always something on the horizon. There's always the next project. There's always this. There's always that. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. When I worked at H&R Block, there was a couple. I had them, I think, for 4 of the 5 years that I worked for Block. They were a young couple. She was a surgical nurse or an ICU nurse or something like that. She had a very good job, and she was paid very, very well. He was, I think, some kind of a salesman or something. I don't remember exactly what he did. She actually made more money than he did. But this young couple made very good money. They made very good money. And I have never seen two people with more harebrained money-making schemes in my life. Every year, they came in, they had a new business. And this business was going to bring them gobs of money. And they were just starry-eyed when they talked about this. First year I had them, they had cashed in some retirement money, and they had, as I recall, they were going to sell health food stuff. They had found this company that sold all this great health food stuff, and they're going to sell you health food, and you come to their little health food parties, and they're going to make a fortune with this. They had cashed in something like $10,000 of retirement money, and bought all of this stuff. And you know what they did with it? They gave it away as free samples. Because they were convinced that this stuff was so good, you would just climb all over yourself to come buy it from them. 2 years later, that business was off their tax return. Wow. And then the last year that I worked with Block, he had this idea. He was going to patent, you know these little magic ladders that fold up like, and you can fit them in your shirt pocket, you know, that kind of thing? These collapsible, folding up ladders that are marvelous and wonderful. Well, he had a spin on that. He was going to make one. Not only did it fold up, but you could expand it, the width of it, and turn it like into scaffolding. So you could make it contort to all these things and make it wide enough for scaffolding. Now, he was going to get a patent on this. I don't know how much you know about getting a patent. Getting a patent is an expensive thing. You have to pay these lawyers to get research, to do patent research, and they charge by the hour. And then you have to fill out all these forms, and you have to get prototypes made and plans drawn up. It is not cheap to get a patent. And he had already spent, I don't know, thousands and thousands of dollars on this magic bullet. And verse 19, but he who follows empty pursuits will have poverty in plenty. They made good money, and they just flushed it down the toilet. My term, disposable income. I think of this couple, and I think of, we're just flushing money down the toilet. Just with nonsensical, basically it's greed. What is your, how you spend your spare money, how you spend your spare time, what does it say about the priorities that you have? There's nothing wrong with shopping, but shopping shouldn't be your God. There's nothing wrong with vacation, but vacation is not the ultimate goal of life. There's nothing wrong with hobbies. There's nothing wrong with gardening. There's nothing wrong with stamp collecting or whatever else you want to do. There's nothing wrong with any of that. But when it becomes the centerpiece of your life, there's a problem with that because it reflects priorities that have gone to a bad place. How does it affect your time? You know, Ephesians 5 talks about, Ephesians 5 verse 15, we're not to be foolish, but to be wise, making the most of the time, for the days are evil. How do you use your time? Do your priorities and how you use your time and how you use your spare time? All of us have free time. Some of us have more of it than others. And how you use that reflects back on your sense of time and how you view it. It's a gift of God. It's an opportunity. And again, there's nothing wrong with using time for recreational purposes, but you can also waste time. When I think about this, I think a lot of consumer electronics. You can get absorbed in these little apps on your phone and spend hours and hours and hours. It has become a workplace issue in a lot of workplaces where people are just constantly on their phone while they're trying to do their business. That's not good. That kind of thing's not good. I used to have games on my computer, and it got to where it's too much of a temptation. I just took them off my computer. Now they're on my phone. But anyway, but you can sit in your office and start playing solitaire or Tetris or whatever else, and you can just get absorbed in it and just suddenly lose track of time. You got to be responsible in the way that you use time. How does pleasure affect your reputation? There are a couple of passages in Proverbs I want you to notice. Proverbs chapter 26. And I've met people like this. Proverbs 26 in verse 19. Proverbs 26 verse 18. Like a madman who throws arrows, firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, "Was I not joking?" Just kidding. Have you ever known anybody like that? Years ago, I knew a man who was a Christian, and I think half of everything that came out of his mouth was punctuated with the phrase, "Just kidding." He would come up and just say something outlandish. And he had this deadpan expression. You never knew exactly if he was telling you the truth or not. And after a while, it just gets to a point where everything that came out of his mouth, "I'm just kidding, just kidding, just playing with you there, just pulling your leg." At a point, you're not sure if you ought to take this person seriously or not. And I think it's a character issue. Look, jokes are fine. Practical jokes are fine. Joking with people, wonderful. But when it gets to a point that you're never really sure if this person is telling you the truth, you got an issue. And let me give you a Bible example of this. Over in Genesis chapter 19, when fire and brimstone are falling on Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot is trying to get his family out of the house. And I don't know if you've ever noticed this or not, but in Genesis chapter 19, Lot went out and spoke to his, this is verse 14, Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were to marry his daughters and said, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. They weren't sure if he was joking or not. Let me tell you, if fire and brimstone are falling in my neighborhood, you'll know I'm serious. I won't be joking. But apparently Lot's character was such that, well, here's another Lot joke. Here's Lot at it again. They actually thought he was joking about the city being destroyed. And I think that's a reflection on the kind of character, the kind of personality that Lot had. His reputation was such, I get the impression Lot was something of a jokester. And here, in a critical moment, when his family's life is on the line, his sons-in-law just thought he was making a joke, and it cost them their life. And finally, how does pleasure affect your contentment? It's very easy to become obsessed with pleasure and material things and possessions. Again, from the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 14. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 30. A tranquil heart is life to the body, but passion is rottenness to the bone. We can get in a foment about all kinds of things. That couch. Oh, it's just horrible. We've had that thing for years. We need to get rid of that thing. Honey, what are we going to do about this couch? What are we going to do about the wallpaper or the painting? Honey, I need a tool. Oh, if I just had this tool, my life would be so much easier. Or, oh, honey, this car's got too many miles on it. We got to do something about this. And we can do whatever possession you want. The apartment that we're living in, I'm in love with it. It has an attached garage. I've never had an attached garage. One of my life's purposes was to have an attached garage. And finally, at the age of 55, I have one. I'm living the good life. Oh, for years, every place I lived, we had detached garages. Detached garages, that's not good enough. And many of our garages had dirt floors. And you had to walk 50 feet to go to the car. How awful is that? It's terrible. And this is a double garage. So I'm living the high life. I'm finally content after all of these years. It's amazing what we can turn into one of our life's ambitions. And the Bible teaches us over and over and over, we need to be careful that our desires and our possessions don't consume us. Ecclesiastes chapter 2 in verse 1, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. And again, per se, there's nothing wrong with that. And behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, it is madness. And of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see that there was good for the sons of men to do under the heaven for the few years of their lives. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of trees. I made ponds of water for myself. This guy's got way too much landscaping going on. And he determined at long last, all of this, he said, was futility. We need to practice contentment while we're enjoying our pleasures. I want to end with a quotation I found several years ago. J.I. Packer said, the Christian mission on earth is not unrelieved heroic misery. Here's a clue. You can be happy as a Christian. You can enjoy life as a Christian. In fact, I think if anybody ought to be able to enjoy life, it ought to be children of God. Because we have been given the best of everything, the very best of heaven itself has been given to us, and that ought to help us put everything else in perspective. And when you have the right perspective, you should be able to enjoy things a whole lot better. So here's the application I want you to make. This week, go enjoy yourself. This week, go have some fun. Do it in the right way. Do it with the right motives, the right attitude. But by all means, as much as possible, enjoy yourself. You know, it's interesting to me, every aspect of our life, including fun, is regulated by God. God is very much concerned about every detail of our life, even in the matter of enjoying ourselves. Now, God is not a spoil sport. He's not just sitting up in some gigantic rocking chair in heaven with a bullwhip and, they're going to go to the movies. I'm going to zap them. No. He wants us to enjoy ourselves. He wants us to have some fun. He takes pleasure in things. His son on earth enjoyed things, enjoyed the company of others. And all through the Bible, we have these hints that there's nothing wrong with having a good life. We just need to do it responsibly. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, we want to conclude our services by giving you an opportunity to obey Jesus as Lord. If you are a Christian and maybe there's something wrong with your life, maybe there's something you're doing that and you're struggling with it spiritually, we want to help you with that. Whatever your need is, we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.